Proceed with case number one, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kim Eaton, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter. Your Honor, this court has consistently held that trustees are held to a high standard of conduct and must exercise the highest degree of fidelity and the utmost good faith in the administration of the trust. And the trustee's primary responsibility is to the beneficiary. And with all due respect to the trial court, I believe that in finding a summary judgment in favor of these defendants, the trial court turned that presumption on its head, and we have a new doctrine called beneficiary beware. Because in this instance, with respect to every fact that had been presented, and this is a very fact-intensive case, as is evident by the Rule 56.1 statements, 150 on one hand, 250 on the other, the trial judge had to weigh those facts, determine some that were uncontested, even though in fact they had been qualified, and then enter summary judgment against this trust, this current trustee, in order to reach that result. And we would submit that was there for several reasons. First of all, with respect to the doctrine of laches, the trial court held that even though it found a 5-year statute of limitations applied, that statute could be cut off by the doctrine of laches, even though there may be legal claims. And I say there may be. The trial judge never really reached that determination that these were legal or equitable, but held that it could be cut off in either instance. And we would submit that under Illinois law, laches does not apply in a trust context where Illinois protects the beneficiaries. When you read the cases under Illinois law, beneficiaries are a protected class. They are given more protection than most parties that come before the court. Yet in this instance, the focus was on the beneficiary's conduct in almost all instances. With respect to laches, which was raised by the trial court in deciding that certain claims could be cut off, he held that not only did it apply where there are legal claims, and we would dispute that, as we did in our briefs, because that's not the law under Illinois, and that's not the law as this court held in Jefferson National in 1983, that laches does not apply where there are legal claims. But the court went on to find not only does it apply, but in this instance, the delay caused prejudice. And the court searched the record for that prejudice, even though the parties had not briefed that, and pointed to the unavailability of two witnesses, and then also the suggestion that if the current beneficiaries had come to the trustee at that time and had alerted him as to this diversification issue, that somehow he would have changed his conduct. That was a stretch, with all due respect, and that was not a matter that had been briefed. With respect to the statute of limitations,
what does the trust document say about the duty to diversify the assets?
The trust document, Your Honor, does two things. One, it incorporates the Trust and Trustees Act of the State of Illinois. It says in addition to. And then it gives fairly wide discretion to the trustee to exercise his or her judgment as to how the assets should be diversified. There's no explicit instructions that it should only be in bonds, it only should be in equities. It gives the trustee discretion. And in exercising that discretion, we submit in our allegations in the complaint that there was a breach of duty there because the diversification was lacking. It was almost entirely in bonds. We would have evidence to submit that there would be a considerable more in the estate, in the trust estate, if they had diversified. There was an issue raised in the trial court through the 56.1 statement that this was the widow's desire, as it had been her husband's, to focus principally in bonds. However, the affidavit, which was submitted in the 56.1 statement by the plaintiff from Mary Schwartz, indicated that when Mr. Kamen was a trustee, he never consulted her about her desires or wishes. it's undisputed that he just relied upon representations that had been made to him by his co-trustee that that was her desire. And she said in her affidavit, if I had been instructed or advised that that may have been the best strategy to diversify more, I would have listened. She didn't say how she would have acted, but she says, I would have listened. That creates a fact dispute as to the issue of diversification. With respect to the statute of limitations, again, the trial court had to find that these beneficiaries had notice that they should be bringing a claim against a trustee. And when you look at Illinois law as to what's required by notice, and it was also true in this court's decision in Jefferson National, it requires a repudiation. It requires something dramatic from the trustee. And in Jefferson National, that dramatic event was, we can no longer represent you, beneficiaries, because we have multiple conflicts. In that case, they had a commercial loan the bank had made in addition to administering the trust. That was enough to trigger the statute of limitations in that case. The defendants rely principally on the case of Kay versus Village of Mundelein in their brief. And in that case, that was a situation where the village said, who was holding funds on behalf of the beneficiaries, we are no longer going to pay you. We feel our obligation has been met. That was a dramatic event that triggered the statute of limitations. In both cases, that was a repudiation. In this case, the district court's opinion largely focuses on the beneficiary and what the beneficiaries knew or should have known. And with all due respect, that is not the law in Illinois. The law protects beneficiaries. The law allows the beneficiaries to rely, an unbridled reliance upon the trustee and the trustee's judgment.
Well, who is the beneficiary supposed to sue if somebody is not operating correctly? Because I have some question about your standing in this case as well.
I'll be happy to address both questions. First, with respect, Your Honor, with the standing in this case. The trust provided that the Trust and Trustees Act of the State of Illinois was incorporated into the trust document. In the Trust Act, it provides that when there's a vacancy, the remaining beneficiary has the power to act. Secondly, in this trust document itself, in the declaration in paragraph 1, it says where the document refers to plural trustees, that it can be read in the singular where there's one trustee. So it contemplated a situation where there would be a vacancy. And third, it makes
yes,
sense.
But in contemplating that, didn't it also contemplate filling the vacancy?
It
in
did.
In order to have a corporate co-trustee.
But the difficulty, Your Honor, in reading it where only where there was just one vacancy, where there was just one trustee and that trustee couldn't act, it would essentially paralyze the trust. And, for example, there was an accounting on May 10th, or May 11th, I believe, in 1998. If there was a challenge to that accounting, they had to bring an action within 3 years. In this case, because the vacancy occurred on May 7th, under the reading of the district court's interpretation of standing, there wouldn't have been a trustee that could have brought that cause of action. The trust would have been harmed. And that is not the intent of the trust. That is not the intent of the Trust and Trustees Act in Illinois, because the purpose of the trust document is to protect the beneficiaries, and the beneficiaries are to be left with this protection at all times. This document did not restrict a single trustee from taking an action that's for the benefit of the trust. And we submit in this case, when Ms. Scottfrey became the trustee and there was a vacancy in the corporate trustee position, which was filled later, 2 months later, she had the power to act on behalf of the trust and on behalf of the beneficiaries.
Could be once the co-trustee were appointed, would that person or entity have the power to rescind or do whatever she did, or not endorse? By not endorsing it, it would not be valid.
Your Honor, it didn't happen here, but what the district court held was that you look at the standing at the time the lawsuit was filed, and in looking at the time the lawsuit was filed, there was only one trustee who had the power to bring that. If, for example, Comerica, who was appointed in July 2 months later, decided to challenge the fact that this lawsuit was being pursued by the one trustee. Yes, I assume that the challenge could have been made. That has not happened. I don't think by their silence necessarily that's acquiescence, but it's not happened. There's not been that challenge. And they're obviously well aware of the fact that the lawsuit has occurred. And they've taken no action since they've been appointed to do anything about it. They've allowed the trustee to pursue this action.
Then it's your position that they can act even without a family trustee?
That's correct. At that point, it was the corporate trustee where there was a vacancy. The family trustee.
It ruled if the trust instrument provides that the family trustee position may go unfilled, but that the institutional position may not?
It absolutely does hold that. But it does not restrict the right of the family trustee to act on the best interest of.
Well, there is no family trustee. That's what we're talking about.
Well, there was.
That's we say when it's unfilled. That means there isn't anybody there.
Okay. No, Your Honor, I agree. At the time this lawsuit was filed, though, Mrs. Godfrey, the plaintiff, was the family trustee.
Right.
It was the corporate trustee. Certainly, the corporate trustee can act alone as well, and the trust document contemplates at some point there won't be a family trustee because it
yes,
only
it
names
does.
Three people.
Yes, it does.
So what we're arguing and what I believe is the law with respect to a situation when there is a vacancy, the family trustee can act. Otherwise, the beneficiaries would be harmed because there would be no one there to assume that responsibility. And here, as a matter of fact, there was over a two-month gap. And by incorporating the Trust and Trustees Act of Illinois, which provides that when there's a vacancy, that sole trustee can
which
act.
Law takes precedence?
Well, in this case, they're not even consistent.
We have a little conflict here, don't we?
No, Your Honor, we do not. And if there is a conflict, to answer your question, the trust document takes precedence. But there's no conflict, because in this case, the trust document assumes, by the language in paragraph 1, that a trustee can act alone. And it doesn't distinguish between the family trustee or the corporate trustee. It doesn't say only the corporate trustee can act alone. It says that if it says trustees and there's one, while there's one, that trustee can act alone. And that's in paragraph 1 of the declaration. So we submit there's no conflict between the Illinois Act and this trust document that gives her standing to bring this action. And in closing for this part, before I say the remainder of my time for rebuttal, I would also indicate that if this court finds that latches does not apply to these legal claims, the trial court held that there still is a period of time under the statute of limitations between May 96 and July 97 that relates to the diversification claim that would not be cut off. Also, the trial court did find, as a matter of fact, that there was a dispute as it relates to the conflicts by Jenner and Block and the trustees and the First Midwest loan made on the Mark Williams debt. But it removed that issue from the statute of limitations analysis and then just found there was no damages. And in fact, the record's not clear that there were no damages. We know that the First Midwest loan was not collected in full, but we don't know how much it wasn't collected, and that was $250. The loan that was unsecured was $200. So, Your Honors, we would ask in your consideration of all these various claims, if you will look to see what survives when the analysis is done. We would submit that all of it survives and that the summary judgment should be reversed. Thank you. I would save the remaining portion of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I think we have to step back for a moment and consider that this case concerns the undisputed facts regarding summary judgment on the statute of limitations and other legal grounds. The claims here arise primarily from the family's efforts in 1988 and 1989 to continue a family business, which were subject to extensive discussion among the family and debate with advice of counsel. There's no claim of self-dealing, which distinguishes all of the cases cited by the plaintiff. The actions of the defendants were consistent with the family consensus, but as a matter of law, putting all that to one side, it's just too late to revisit those matters. First, on standing, the trust agreement is clear here. The trust agreement requires two trustees to take action.
The law in Illinois is clear that where a trust provides that there shall be two trustees, both trustees must take action. But here it's even more explicit because the grantor wanted a corporate independent trustee. The trust agreement provides that he wanted this check and balance on his family members who were trustees. So the fact that the corporate trustee has not authorized this suit bars the suit. If, in fact, there was this period of time in which only Mrs. Godfrey could act, and she needed to act before the statute of limitations, that could have been cured following the appointment of Comerco by having Comerco ratify the action. That hasn't occurred. In order for this action to proceed, in order for her to have standing, the bank would have to ratify it. And this is the same situation the court had the last time this case was up here, because they had brought suit, and the Harris Bank at that time was the corporate trustee, and the Harris Bank wouldn't sue. And so the Harris Bank then resigned, and the new corporate trustee won't sue either. There's no standing here.
What about the claim that acquiescence or doing nothing doesn't override her acting unilaterally?
That's just not the law in First National Bank versus Edgeworth. The corporate trustee has to weigh in and take an affirmative position in support of the suit in order for it to be a valid suit.
The state law says that once that, what is it, Co-America or something like that? What's the name?
Co-America.
Once that institutional trustee is in place, it has to take an affirmative act to either endorse or, I guess, a negative act to say no.
That's our position, yeah.
What is your position when it doesn't do anything?
That the suit is improper, that the trustee lacks standing. The corporate trustee has to take affirmative action in support of the suit to provide appropriate standing. In terms of the statute of limitations, the facts here, again, are clear on the statute of limitations. These loans occurred in 1988 and 1989, and as Judge Gettleman painstakingly points out, all of the facts were disclosed to the plaintiffs. Now, on this point, the plaintiffs contend that Mr. Olson did not tell them that Embassagraph wouldn't be able to repay the loans, that Embassagraph had financial difficulties, and it's on their brief pages 5 and 32, that he had made no investigation of Embassagraph, that their loans were prudent. Well, the record shows first that those assertions just aren't true. The undisputed facts show that. You have Mrs. Godfrey's notes of her meeting with Olson where he laid it all out. You've got Mr. Olson writing in 1989 saying, we've made all these loans, more loans are necessary, 31589, which Judge Gettleman quotes, requesting a release. And that puts, as Diane Williams and Mrs. Godfrey then write, that puts them in a tizzy, and they go to a lawyer to find out about that. Second, Embassagraph was sold in 1989. The loans weren't repaid in 1989. They were on notice in 1989 that the loans weren't going to be repaid. Whatever Mr. Olson told them about the possibility they'd be repaid, whatever complaint they had, they weren't repaid. Third, how could there be any concealment here, as they allege, because the loans were made to their brother, Robert. This was a family business. Their loans were made to Robert, who was a co-trustee. This was a family participation.
Were they residual beneficiaries? What was Godfrey at that point?
All three children were residual beneficiaries. The mother, Mary Schwartz, was the income beneficiary.
And the mother beneficiary, they wouldn't have any power to do anything, would they?
Well, they would have power. They would have power, yes. As the court held before, they would have power to sue the current trustee. The decision by this court before was that contingent beneficiaries don't have the power to sue former trustees, but they do have the power to sue the current trustee. If they were upset about what Mr. Olson was doing in 1988 and 1989, they could have sued him.
What does the trust doctrine say about such conflicts between the co-trustees?
Oh, it expressly says that he authorizes that, and he authorizes in the trust document the loans to Embassagraph
No, I said if there are conflicts between them, how shall they be resolved?
Between the trust...
Between the...
Between Robert as a co-trustee,
right,
and the... Well, the trust document, it doesn't speak directly to conflicts. It authorizes Robert to be the trustee, but it speaks directly to the fact that the father recognizes that loans can be made to these companies which are run by Robert.
Right.
So he acknowledges that Robert is in a...
I understand that, but the document itself does not provide for any procedure if there are conflicts between the co-trustees.
Well, I think the document exonerates, I don't know the precise language, but I think it recognizes Robert's position and says that's fine.
Well, that's all I was
saying.
That's
fine.
What I was asking.
Right. But there again on the reduction of the Mark Williams loan. There again, it's a subject of extensive discussion, and there again, Arthur Freeman sent the letter. Now, they allege in their brief that Arthur Freeman was only acting for Mary and has nothing to do with them. But the record shows, and Judge Gettleman quotes, that Ellen Godfrey wrote back to Arthur Freeman and said, thanks for your advice, but we're satisfied. We want to support Robert. Her letter says, we want to support Robert. We want to reduce this loan. The same situation prevails with respect to the closing of the estate. The closing of all of these events about which they complain, the bulk of these events, occurred in 1988 and 1989. The loans to Embasagraph, the reduction of the Mark Williams debt, and the investment strategy, all the investment bonds, they all occurred before the closing of the estate. The estate closed in 1990. Here again, Arthur Freeman writes to the beneficiaries and says, you realize that if you consent in writing to the closing of this estate, you're cutting off all rights of action you have for anything that Mr. Olson did. And Ellen Godfrey writes back and says, I understand that, but that's our decision. And, Mr. Freeman advises them not to consent to the closing of the estate, says, do some more inquiry. They say, no, we're satisfied. We know these loans were made. We know the reason the loans were made. We made them to support our brother. We're going forward with that. Now, one issue here in the statute of limitations is, first, does a breach start the running of the and here the law, as Your Honor held in Jefferson Bank, Jefferson National Bank, the law in Illinois in Kay versus Village of Mundelein, that a breach is sufficient to start the statute of limitations. You don't need a total repudiation. And this illustrates the difference in the Jefferson National Bank's case illustrates the difference between self-dealing or concealment and this kind of case. Jefferson National Bank, the bank had a customer that held a note that was adverse to the trust. There's no way that the beneficiaries of the trust could know what the bank could know who the bank's customers were. So when the bank revealed that it had a customer adverse, that was a breach. The bank was still the trustee, but the cause of action arose. Here they always knew that Robert was the person on the other side who was receiving the loans. Again, in North versus Wirtz, the holding is clear, citing both of these cases, that repudiation exists whenever the beneficiary is put on notice of acts that would reasonably alert her to the possibility of breach. The standard that's been set by this court in Whitlock Corporation and in Norris versus Wirtz is the statute begins to run when a reasonable person would have appreciated the need for further inquiry. And if the complaint here is that these loans to the Embasagraph were imprudent, that the write-down of the Mark Williams debt was imprudent, when those companies failed and when they didn't collect that money in 1988-1989, that was sufficient notice. The court of course dismissed the case on summary judgment on multiple grounds. Consent to the closing of the account, statute of limitations is 5 years. Latches really overlaps the statute of limitations, but it does cover that last 14 months of investment towards the end of Cayman's period of trusteeship. But here the court was, there is a record here, contrary to what they say. We sought to take Mr. Freeman's deposition, and his lawyer objected, and the court held a hearing and said Mr. Freeman was too ill. He's since died, unfortunately, too ill to be deposed. The plaintiff sought to depose Mr. Olson. We had a hearing. A doctor testified by affidavit. There again, the record was made. So the prejudice was clear there. Beyond that, you have the record in this case, and there is no dispute. It's cited in Judge Gettleman's opinion again that Mrs. Godfrey writes a letter, which is very telling. She says, I've discussed this with Robert. Our mother is very risk averse. She's 85 years old. She wants to stay in bonds. We would like her to go into stock. We've argued with her. We've asked her to diversify into stock, but she insists on bonds, and her views, we've decided the family, all three beneficiaries, Robert, Diane, Ellen, that her views are paramount. That's quoted in the record. So it was a family consensus communicated through the accountant and through younger lawyers at General Block to Mr. Kamen that's what the mother insisted upon, and that's what she was comfortable with, and the children deferred to her. And so there was no reason for Mr. Kamen to overrule the family on that. There's no question that Ellen Godfrey was aware of that situation. To the extent that there's a question of notice here under the statute of limitations, she and her sister both went to a lawyer in New York to consult a lawyer in New York about whether they had a cause of action and whether the investment strategy should be changed. Finally, the judge held that the discharge of Mr. Olson as a trustee and executor started the statute, cuts off all actions against Mr. Olson. The plaintiffs seem to argue that the statute will never end because every day that Mr. Kamen didn't sue Mr. Olson for these alleged wrongdoings, the loan and the write-down of the Mark Williams debt and the investments, that they have a new cause of action against Mr. Kamen. Well, first of all, the statute and the Illinois law, as we quote, imposes no duty, expressly protects a successor trustee from having to sue his predecessor trustee. In this instance, there was no cause of action against Mr. Olson because the closing of the estate cut off any cause of action that could be asserted. So there was no basis on which, no legitimate basis on which Mr. Kamen could have sued Mr. Olson. Now, if the plaintiffs had thought there was a legitimate basis on which Mr. Kamen should have sued Mr. Olson, as this court held in the previous appeal, they could have demanded that he sue them, and then if he refused, they could have gone to court and sought the right to sue derivatively Mr. Olson. But they didn't do that because there was no cause of action, and Mr. Kamen acted perfectly appropriately upon assumption of his duties as trustee. If there's no further questions, I would ask that the trial court be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge Coffey, with respect to your question on what the trust document provided for if there was a conflict, the trust document provided that if there was a conflict between the family and the corporate trustee, a third trustee would be appointed, Harris Bank, and Harris Bank would resolve the conflict, and then they would no longer serve as trustees. So they did provide for that situation. Counsel talked about the fact that they saw a need for an independent trustee. Yet if you look at each one of these facts, what the trustee did was rely upon the family, and what counsel is pointing to in almost every instance is the conduct of the beneficiaries and what they knew or didn't know to determine that they have no rights. In the Rule 56.1 statements that were submitted by the plaintiff and by the defendant, there are over 400 facts which are alleged to be undisputed, yet each party qualified or denied each other. Yet the trial court at every instance found facts out of these 400 plus facts that would favor the trustees and shield them from the lawsuit from the beneficiaries. And even where he found that there was a fact dispute, he cut the write-off because there were no damages or because there was no standing. In every instance, the presumption went against the non-moving party, and that's not the law, and these beneficiaries should be entitled to their day in court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you.